Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Hi everyone, welcome to the RSA. I'm Matthew Taylor, I'm the Chief Executive here. I'm delighted to welcome you to today's special event. Now, it's my great pleasure to welcome today's distinguished guest speaker, Raghu Rajan. Raghu is a renowned economist and academic, professor of finance at University of Chicago. He's written and co-authored several books, including the recently published The Third Pillar, The Revival of Community in a Polarized World, which I've been reading for the last few days, and which he'll be sharing some of the insights in that book with us today. It's a fascinating exploration of the imbalances that have emerged in our public life, where community and civil society have too often been forgotten. In a context of globalization, of rapid technological change, Raghu explores how to revive the communal bonds that connect us to one another. So it'll be the usual RSA format. Raghu's going to speak for around 20 minutes. We'll have a bit of a conversation on the stage, and then we'll open it up to your questions. So without any further ado, please welcome Raghu Rajan.
Thank you. Good afternoon. And let me move quickly through a brief presentation of the ideas in the book. 20 minutes is enough for me to outline the problems, not enough to outline what I think might be remedies, but I think we'll reserve that to the discussion afterwards. But so here is what this is about. The standard view of capitalism is about free competitive markets. And if you're at the University of Chicago, you don't need anything more. If you're elsewhere, you sort of think you need a government to enforce contracts and property rights. And of course, through the 19th century, governments have gone beyond that to create safety nets, sometimes to take care of education and so on, what I call post-market and pre-market supports. But all this tends to neglect this whole discussion about how much government, how much markets, tends to neglect that one of the bigger forces propping up society, the third pillar, is the community. And the community, both directly by preparing children, preparing them for school and preparing them beyond that, by giving them a sense of values for participation in society, but also when markets and the state fail the individual. For example, during the global financial crisis, when in Southern Europe you had a prolonged recession, people essentially had no support structure other than their community, their families, their relatives, and their village. They went back there. So the community works in providing all this, but also indirectly through democracy. It makes capitalism work for the many. And this is important. Democracy is an essential part of why capitalism works. There are very few successful capitalist societies without a strong democracy. And I emphasize the links in this book. And when capitalism offers opportunities for many to succeed, the many tend to support capitalism. That, I would argue, essentially was the post-war balance that we had struck in the liberal market democracies that emerged in industrial countries. That was very successful, but we've seen lately that it stopped working and stopped working for all. And I want to argue why, I want to explain why I think the balance has become perturbed and what we need to fix it. And that's really much of what the book is about. So let me walk quickly through definitions. I mean, by markets, I mean the whole realm of markets, goods markets, labor markets, where you look for jobs, capital markets, where firms issue bonds and stock, and of course, players in the markets, including private firms. What markets do well is enhance productivity, that's efficiency, and also give consumers choice. So both on the production side as well as the consumption side, they work very well. The state is the traditional three aspects of the state: the executive, the judiciary, the legislature. Historically, It's been about securing security and justice for people. More recently, it's also been about helping people both prepare for markets, that's the pre-market support, get the capabilities to participate, the schooling, the education, the skills, but also post-market support, the safety nets, in case the markets hit you really hard, to support you as you fall off, the unemployment insurance and so on that it provides. And finally, the community, the third pillar. I focus largely on the proximate community, the neighborhood, the village, the municipality. Of course, there are other variants of the community, and I'll talk a little bit about the virtual community in a second. But primarily, this is the community that most people in the world know and recognize. This is the proximate community, not so much in London, but certainly outside the big metropolitan cities of the world. That's what the community is about. And I include in the community local government, as well as local institutions like schools. Now, of course, people say, and certainly in metropolitan cities, I often get the reaction, what's a community? I don't really know a community. I sort of know some people at work, but pretty much I don't know my neighbors. But in many parts of the world, the community still has an important role, a role in providing a sense of identity. I belong to thus and such village. I belong to thus and such town. And a set of values. Here is what we stand for as a community. It does exactly the same thing the government does. Security, justice, capabilities, safety net, those are the exact same things I said the government provided. Except what the community does is it's not a contractual relationship. It's not a relationship of rights. The government has to do this for me. It is a something based on relationships where it fills in holes. When the government stops working, when the market stops working, the community starts filling those holes. So when, for example, the safety net is no longer available from the government, I move into my parents' house, because they're always there for me. It also forms the basis of political organization. It is, in a sense, the fundamental sort of building block of political organization. And that's also very important, because what is to keep the market, the elite in the market, from coalescing with the elite in government? This has always been the historical problem of capitalism. It's a problem that Adam Smith talked about a lot in The Wealth of Nations. And to my mind, what keeps it separate is something that wasn't prominent in Adam Smith's time, democracy. Democracy working on behalf of ordinary people tends to intervene to keep the market and the government separate. And I'll come back to that in just a bit, because some of the historical sort of emphasis on the book is on that. Now, even in this day and age, even in the anonymous city, we still constantly try and find ways of recreating community. For example, I do live in a city in Chicago, and in that neighborhood, we try and build links to each other through the neighborhood school. We are close friends with the parents of the children who are friends of our kids. That's how we spread our relationships. But of course, there are many other voluntary structures, including structures like this one, the RSA, by which we meet, engage, and develop relationships outside the professional and transactional ones. Why do I emphasize local community in this day and age when we have virtual communities? I believe that the local community still is a community where we can trust. It's much harder to trust across the internet. We don't know the person we're interacting with is a real person or a bot. But it's also much easier to opt in and opt out. In the virtual community, we get light engagement. We do get massive engagement. It's possible to summon up a flash mob in a second to protest something or the other, but it's hard to keep that mob engaged coming back day after day as you need in a real organization. But I don't want to denigrate the possibility of the virtual community getting strength over time. What is true today is virtual interacts positively in many situations with the real. What I talk about in the book is an actual example of a developer in Canada who was putting together a development in Toronto, and he wired half the houses together and then ran into a technical glitch, also some funding problems, where he couldn't wire the other half. And for the sociologist, this is a wonderful experiment. Half are wired, the other half aren't wired. This was random. Let's see how the half that are wired do. Do they build better relationships, or does the half that is unwired build better relationships? Now, there are arguments for both. Some people say the internet consumes your time. You don't spend time building real relationships. You're stuck always on the net. It turns out, though, the people who are wired had stronger relationships. They had more parties. They recognized each other. They spoke to each other more often. And the sociologist asked why, and it turns out that the net helps you cross closed doors. If you wanted to have a party in the evening, you sent an email to everybody, they came. That was easy. If you wanted to organize a search party for your missing kids or missing dog, it was easy to organize within the wired community. So the wired community allowed extra means of contact, which added to the direct contact that people had, so they recognized each other much more, they interacted with each other much more. And my guess is this is something that you must experience. Many of you look as if you have kids, and I certainly find that my kids are in much closer contact with their friends through social media than we were with our friends, because for us it meant a phone call to each one. For them, it means just one message across the group of their friends. So I think the virtual helps the real to establish greater contact. But I also think the real is going to become much more important in the future. As jobs get automated, as relationships become, to some extent, as work becomes more automated, I think increasingly we will move towards the real relationships as the core of work. But also, we will have a lot of people who will fear the fact that they don't really have those real relationships. The problem of loneliness is expanding. It's there in a number of countries already. People who grew up in small families, where the families have broken, and sometimes family members have died, this is an increasing problem. And to my mind, society has to find ways of dealing with it, and creating those real relationships is part of the answer. So here is really the essence of the book, which is that the three pillars are in balance. And that was what made the liberal market society possible. Now, some of these arrows I've already mentioned, and you know, the state provides legislation, regulation, property rights, etc. And the state provides security and justice for the community. But some of these are less obvious. An independent market, a comparative independent market, provides a countervailing power to the state. Example, in the United States, you have an independent press which checks the administration. The New York Times, the Washington Post, funded independently, essentially acts as a check on the current administration. In many emerging markets, the press is much more submissive. Why is it submissive? Because it depends on the government for contracts. It depends on the government for advertisement. Some of them are owned by large conglomerates who depend on the government for tariffs and so on. That reduces the independence of the private sector. So it's very important the markets be comparative and free, because that creates a power which is separate from the government, imposes checks and balances, and prevents the government from becoming authoritarian. Again, that goes to the point, it's very hard to find a socialist economy which is fully democratic. You'd be hard-pressed to find one. On the other hand, it's easier to find a capitalist economy which is democratic. And I think that's because of the balance of power between the private sector and the government. The other arrow, the state and the community provides democratic oversight, and that's critical to the balance because it keeps the separation between the state and the markets. Markets and the state, as I said, have a tendency to collude. The big operators in the market tend to get cozy with big government, and they tend to collude together. That was Adam Smith's greatest worry. That is what happens in communist economies, where the state and the market are one. That's exactly what happens in fascist economies, where, again, the state and the big players get together. What keeps them separate is democratic oversight. And again in the United States, for example, you find when the state and the markets get too close, you have democratic protest. You had it in the 19th century with the populist movement, where the farmers felt they were being oppressed by the big railroads, which were charging them huge rates. They were being oppressed by the banks, which were charging them enormous amounts. There was a reaction. And that populist movement led to the Sherman Antitrust Act, attempts to control the size of large corporations. And through the progressive movement, it led to the creation of things like the Federal Drug and Administration Agency to control the quality of produce from the firms. The Federal Reserve was created in part as part of the progressive movement to control the power of the big banks. And over time, this even in the 30s resulted in Glass-Steagall. Today, we find a similar popular reaction sort of creeping together. And this time, it's against big tech. You read about it in the papers all the time, but there is a worry that there's an enormous concentration of power in big tech. It's not just about what the consumer experiences, but also the kind of power that is concentrated there, and you get the reaction. Last point, the community also creates values and norms for the market. The market is not independent of the community. What the market values is often determined by what the community thinks is appropriate. In the book, I talk about values in medieval society, which were often saying, don't make too much profit. There is a just profit you can make, a just price you can charge. If you make more than that, you're subject to the sin of avarice, which will doom your chances of going to heaven. And in that era, going to heaven was much more important than life, everyday life. So that was a serious penalty. Contrast that today with what we tell corporations. Maximize profits. Charge the highest price you can get, because that's your duty to shareholders. So we've changed. We've come a long way, and we can change again. We can change again as society changes values, and I talk about what might be appropriate values. So let me talk finally in the last 3 or 4 minutes about the causes of the imbalance. And causes of the imbalance are really two, typically two. What shifts the balance between the pillars is either great calamity. The Black Death, for example, in many ways led to the demise of the feudal system. Great depressions, two of them, the one that we always talk about and the one between 1873 and 1893, these caused enormous social change, including the emergence of safety nets across the industrial countries, driven by these really across-the-board deep depressions. But today, the biggest factor is technological change. Just as the first and second industrial revolution created enormous change, the information and communications technology revolution is creating change. And let me describe how. Three ways. One, it is changing markets. Markets have become global. Markets, global supply chains are now permeating many countries. That we all know. The effect of this is often to essentially create a lot of competition for manufacturing jobs which didn't exist earlier. It's also, as many economists have noted, focused on hollowing out middle-level jobs. There are many more jobs which are low-skilled, many more jobs which are very high-skilled, much fewer jobs at the middle. What this implies, I'll come to in a second for communities, but carrying on along this theme, it's also created the domination of industries by superstar firms, much more concentration in the industry. I worry a little bit about whether we have the kind of competition we need going forward. And third, it's created superstar professions. The lady on the left is Elizabeth Billington, the star of the London Opera in 1801. She filled the opera house. We don't hear of her today, but she used to fill the opera house. She earned between 10,000 and 15,000 pounds in that time's currency, which is about $1 million today. Lady on the right, no prizes for guessing, Taylor Swift. She earned $170 million in 2016. 170 times what the lady on the left earned. That's the nature of professions today. Why? She filled only the London Opera House. That means maybe 100,000 people heard her in a season, maximum. Lady on the right, her, you know, one of her songs has been downloaded 6 billion times. 6 billion, not million. Think of the reach, the difference in reach between the two. That's what technology and globalization are doing. Professions are reaching far more people. Therefore, the people at the top are earning much more. Why does that matter? Because it affects the community in a way I will describe shortly. But the second aspect of this globalization of markets is that governance has moved steadily up. As markets become more global, government accompanies it. We always think government and markets are opposed. One fights the other. No, sometimes they work together, they grow together. It used to be that banks used to operate in a town. So capital requirements for banks, how much equity they had to hold, was set at the town level or the community level. Then banks operated across the state, capital requirements at the state level. Then banks operated across the country. Now capital requirements were set in the capital, in Washington or London. And then banks operate internationally. Today capital requirements are largely determined in Basel, which is away from any of the capitals. Governance tends to go increasingly up. Powers get moved from the community, often to the national level, but increasingly to the international level. So the community is hit both by the markets and the government. The markets have hollowed out communities which are hit by trade, Northern England, but the Midwest in the United States. Much more activity moved to mega cities like London, San Francisco, and so on. But technological change, the fact that there are such huge returns to being really good, to being the diva, to being a really good lawyer, means that the returns to education have increased tremendously. So how do I get my kid into Harvard or Yale? To get my kid there, I need to send them to the best schools. Why the best schools? Because that's where they're surrounded by the best kids and they learn the most. Where am I going to find the best school near my neighborhood? I'm going to look for the richest neighborhood around, because that's where the kids have had the best preparation. That's where their parents are professional and therefore speak many more words at home. Their kids have learned a lot of words. Their kids are much more numerate, are much more literate. Early childhood matters. The community matters. I want the best community for my kids. What this has created is essentially a segregation. Increasingly, and this is a factor in the United States, mixed communities have broken apart. The rich have seceded to move into communities of their own. The poor are left behind. The middle, there are far fewer middle class integrated communities than before. So when the rich secede, the secession of the successful essentially creates very different opportunities. The successful have much better opportunities for their kids than the people left behind. Essentially, technology is creating a meritocracy, but this is a meritocracy where really it's become a hereditary meritocracy, where the children of the successful succeed and the rest are left behind. So that is one of the problems. It's not just trade depriving the steel communities, the coal communities. It's not just the fact that technology has hollowed out the middle class jobs. It is also the fact that the opportunity to reach those good jobs is much harder today because there's a premium to education, but educational opportunities are much more differently spread than before because of the disintegration of the mixed community. Last slide and I'll finish. I mean, it's obvious why this creates anger. It's also obvious why the populists have no real answers, because closing walls around our country is not going to help if technology is creating the change. Protecting jobs is not useful if the jobs are being hurt by technological change. It's also true that developed countries are aging. If they're aging and they have large unfunded entitlements, they need people to come in. So stopping immigration entirely is also a bad idea because somebody has to do the work to support the elderly over time. But most important, the rest are growing. It's Africa, it's the Middle East, it's South Asia, which are really young today, where the demand of the future is going to come. To erect barriers against their goods today is going to be shooting ourselves in the foot, because that's where the markets are going to be tomorrow. And finally, we have global problems like climate change. You cannot discuss a solution to global problems at the same time as you're erecting tariffs against everybody else and saying, we don't want any of your people. So the broader point is, this is a wrong time to deglobalize. Instead, the answer is, let's strengthen the community. Let's make it more capable of enhancing opportunity for the people left behind. What do we need to do there? That really is the solution part of the book. But given I have 20 minutes, I'll stop here and we'll talk about those solutions in just a bit. The word I use is inclusive localism, which Matthew has said he's going to probe me about. So we'll stop there.
Thank you, Edgar. That's great. And as you imply, you only skimmed the surface of an incredibly rich book. So my first question is this kind of notion of community and the kind of wanting us to take community more seriously. I don't know whether you quote it in the book, but a public intellectual, Brent David Goodhart, wrote a book in which he distinguished somewheres from nowheres. You know, now you as someone who's Indian, lives in America.
I'm a citizen of nowhere, right?
Well, exactly.
By the definition.
So
of that
I guess
term.
The question to you
I
is
do feel I'm a citizen.
His account would be, well, the problem with the community is that people like you don't want to live in communities. Yeah. The elite are footloose.
Yeah.
It's poor people who have to live in communities. Yeah. And so it's all very well people like us romanticizing communities, but you know that's not actually how we live our lives.
Right. No, so that's a very good question. But I don't think you need to say the community is wonderful in all aspects, and that's why I say there are some aspects of the community which are about exclusion, which become problematic, but which historically has been also a source of identity. What I do want to argue is that there are things the community provides, even people like you and me, which are very beneficial. We do look for relationships. We sometimes find it in family, sometimes extended family, but we also find it in friends. And we do have friends. I mean, they may be friends of 5 years rather than, you know, since childhood. But we do, wherever we go, we feel the sense of the need to build community. So I reject the citizens of nowhere. I mean, we do have allegiances, we do have identities. But we try and also establish roots wherever we are because real people do matter. And that's why I said, you know, you build relationships through the school, you build relationships through voluntary organizations, you build relationships through organizations like this. So I don't think we're rootless. I do think we do absorb different facets of the different communities we travel through. And that variety is not necessarily a bad thing. I think it makes life a little more interesting for this group. I'm not saying this is the only community. And that's why I say in the book, we should allow for all possibilities of communities, communities of people who've lived together forever and don't want to change, as well as communities that are changing, but people are willing to understand and talk to each other and communicate, even though they know each other for a briefer period.
So one of the striking things about the book for me was that I like other people, are reading a lot of books at the moment about the crisis of liberal democracy. And what is different about your book is not polemical, it's not angry, and most of those books are polemical and angry. And I'm kind of interested in that. So a couple of angles on that. I mean, so take this notion of community, go back to this notion of community. Now, the notion of community, the notion of reciprocity, the notion of giving something back. And many people would say, well, you know, the fact that corporations go out to incredible lengths and the management consultancies they use and the accountancy firms they use go to incredible lengths to avoid paying tax in the places where they operate, and the fact that rich individuals similarly go to incredible lengths to avoid paying taxes in the countries where they've made their money, isn't that just quite simply morally wrong? And your vision of reviving community is impossible as long as big businesses and rich individuals don't think, don't understand, don't recognize the necessity of reciprocity.
Right. I mean, that's a good point. And let me push back a little and say not all rich individuals aim to minimize their taxes. No. And there are certain rich individuals who do want to give back a tremendous amount and have focused on doing that. Some of the wealthiest people say they don't want to leave much for their kids and instead want to give back to society in different forms. So let's recognize there's that aspect also, but I see the broader point that you're making. And sure, in fact, the real question there is, in order to get a better balance, should you give up on some of the freedoms that corporations have in order to get a little more sensibility to what their duties are? Now, Milton Friedman would have said, maximize value, but staying within the laws of the land. Now, I think your question is, what if the laws of land allow you to go and set up a home in Luxembourg, which allows you to avoid corporate taxes? There, I think the real problem is really cooperation between states in being able to tax that so that corporations no longer have that ability. In fact, there's a whole OECD program about doing that. I don't think it's necessarily the duty of a corporation to pay more taxes than it owes, but I think it's the duty of the state to make sure the corporation pays taxes. And this, to each his realm, I think the state should work much harder to shut out these loopholes. And, you know, we should ask states that hide some of these corporations to essentially stop doing that.
And I agree with you. I think what the OECD is doing here should give us real hope. But to go back to the kind of more polemical accounts of our crisis, I didn't read every single page, but I'm not sure you used the word neoliberalism once, which is interesting because every other book that I read, you know, neoliberalism is probably, you know, the most common word in the book. And the reason I think this is interesting is because you talk about the impact of particular aspects of capitalism, but you don't talk about the inherent characteristics of capitalism per se. So, you know, Walter Scheidel or Thomas Piketty or David Harvey would be saying, well, no, this isn't to do, you know, yes, technology and yes, globalization are aspects of it, but this is fundamentally the way that capitalism works. It fundamentally is a machine for generating growing inequality, monopolies of power, attempting to extract rents. And what happens is that every once in a while, we forget that and we allow capital free rein to do the stuff that it does, the creative destruction, if you like, and then we have to kind of basically pull it back, and that's right. What this is about.
Right. No, so I recognize the fundamental tendency of capitalism towards monopoly. That is part of the... But I don't think that is the characteristic... That is the characteristic of capitalism that we want to emphasize. The competition between entities is what leads to productivity, what leads to innovation. So I say, how do we get that aspect of capitalism, which is really wonderful for all of us because it creates more opportunity, it breaks the elite, it breaks the sort of stagnation that sets into society. How do we keep that aspect without sort of tolerating that tendency towards monopoly? This has been the age-old question about capitalism. And I think that's where democracy, working on behalf of the disempowered, actually keeps asking questions. Are you working for me or not? And you're right that there is a tendency for it to get more concentrated until it becomes too much. Then you get the movement saying, what's happening? Why is power getting so concentrated? Do I feel that I have no agency at all? You get the democratic movements which protest. That's the good side of the movement. What we have to do is channel the rage in the right direction so that we get the appropriate change. And change has to, in a sense, accommodate these interests. But I don't think the answer is throughout capitalism, because that's been very important in creating the wealth that we have to spread around. And so I would say, channel that rage, channel it against the concentration of power, make for better opportunity, be angry that those parents in the United States can buy their way into the Ivy Leagues. Be angry about that. Be angry that even if they don't buy, a kid in a rural area has a much harder chance getting into Yale or Harvard or into Oxford or Cambridge than somebody in an urban area. But find ways to equalize that opportunity so that they can participate. And throwing out capitalism isn't the answer, because in throwing out capitalism, you often also throw out democracy.
So if democracy is in some ways going to intelligently help to rebalance society and tackle some of these characteristics of modern capitalism, for example, the power of big tech, the problem there, of course, is that there's one thing more unpopular than, you know, corporate leaders, it's politicians. So we have a legitimacy crisis in our democratic institutions as well. Now, you're somebody who's worked very closely in the Indian government and you know, been at the front line, as it were, of trying to work with policymakers and politicians. Do you have a sense, it's not something you talk about a great deal in the book, there a sense of how it is democracy renews its legitimacy?
No. The precise channels through which it works and the fact that it can go off track First, the precise channels differ in each country, and there's a very legitimate fear it could go off track, right? After all, it was democratic forces, and we appeal too often to the 1930s, so I don't want to make this a theme, but certainly it was democratic forces that put Hitler in power. He was elected chancellor by the Germans. And so, yes, you can get an angry electorate sometimes going in the wrong direction. But I do think that having the populist movement asking questions forces the establishment, the elite, to sort of say, what are we doing wrong? And hopefully that engenders a response.
I want to push on this because it's absolutely fascinating. You say in the book, there's one particular point in the book, when you talk about the Trente Glorieuses, the decades after the Second World War, which were very many one-off factors, as you yourself say, but nevertheless, this was a period of rising individual prosperity, rising social wealth, the public realm was being enriched, times of growing individual freedom. At the same time, the West was letting go of its colonial. I mean, these were amazing years for human progress. And what you say about those years is you say the reason for this is because the elite knew about the 30s, it thought about the 30s, there was a kind of sense of whatever differences we might have within the elite, you know, in this country. You might be Labour, I might be Conservative. But, you know, what really matters is that we keep the barbarians at the gate. Actually, this is a joint project, and we must work together. And there's a kind of elite cohesion there.
Yes.
I mean, you look now.
Right.
And within the Conservative Party, there are people who'd rather have a civil war than be in the same room as each other. I mean, literally. Right. They are willing to risk right. massive civil disobedience for internal party conflict. Yeah. Where does the critical mass amongst the elite to make a difference come from?
Now, so this is...
It's not going to be Davos, is it?
No, this is a great question. This is a great question. And to some extent, I write this book because I fear first we'll make the mistakes. And first, we'll go down a path we don't want to go and see that it leads nowhere. I hope not war, but we certainly will go down that path and then we'll say, this is not the way we need to go. Let's go back to trying to build some consensus. And that's partly why I say maybe the solutions are not going to be found at the center. Maybe it's not going to be some grand bargain between the Conservatives and Labour or between the Democrats and the Republicans. And at this point, let the communities take more charge because they're more local. They know their problems. There's much less of an ideological fight there. There's much more of a practical, what do we need to do to get the road to the sort of highway fixed because it's holding back sort of commerce and tourists from coming here. That's the sense of, filling the potholes, practicality, that I think may hold us while these grand fights take place at the center. But I do agree with you that I worry that those fights are taking place. Basically politicians are fiddling while things are burning around them.
A couple more questions for me and then we'll open up. And I could spend the whole day talking about these questions. They're absolutely fascinating. But I think if I was, we've talked about, you and I had a brief conversation about journalists before I came in. And I think if I was a journalist and I was trying to get this onto the front page of the Daily Mail, probably the most explosive idea you have here is this notion of inclusive localism and the idea that people should be allowed, we should think it's fine for people to say, I want to live in a community of people just like myself, with my own rules and my own norms. I mean, this kind of sounds a bit like a kind of Blade Runner future where, you know, people are segregated. You kind of acknowledge that and you say, well, yes, that's a danger, but actually we must balance decentralization with inclusion. I guess my perspective on that, and so this is such a long-winded question, was when I was in government, how you reconcile devolving power and inclusion was kind of the biggest problem for public policy. Yeah. You know, it's not a trivial problem.
It's not. And this is where you actually have terms which sound contradictory. Localism, empowerment, the possibility that you build walls around yourself, segregated communities versus inclusion, which means, you know, level playing field. We all sing Kumbaya together. We're all in it together. And the reality is that there are two aspects to this. One is I would rather we have segregated communities than a segregated country. I would rather that we not define at the country level, here's who belongs, here's who doesn't belong, because that creates much more virulent forces which are much harder to combat. So a majoritarian nationalist structure built around white identity or Hindu identity, I think that's really problematic going forward, because nations also have weapons. And that creates the possibility of much larger conflict. I would rather that identity be established at the community level. Okay, this is my community. Now, at the same time, I do want to fight against segregated communities. This is a thus and such community, it is that. And communities can be a way of expressing identity, of expressing cultural continuity, but let's keep the borders open. Let people come in and out. Let me not practice active discrimination by saying, you know, whites need not apply or African Americans need not apply. So apply the laws of the state on the community. No active discrimination lawsuits if that happens. Have open markets. Markets traverse community borders, so walls are low. But have the sense that you have a community identity. I talk about the Pilsen community, which is a Hispanic American community, largely Mexican immigrants into the US in Chicago. They have a museum of Mexican American history. They have a Mexican identity in that community. But you can go into that community, you can live in that community. Increasingly, whites are moving into that community. That was a war zone. They fixed the crime problem as a community, and now have made it so attractive that whites, which is always a mark of success for a minority community in the US, are moving in a big way. But that's okay also, because they feel themselves, they emphasize the American part also of their community, the Mexican American. They celebrate the 4th of July with gusto. They also celebrate Cinco de Mayo.
So if you were a government politician faced with the dilemma that's currently unfolding, a largely Muslim school, almost entirely Muslim school, in a part of Birmingham, which is also very Muslim, is having an argument because it doesn't want to have to teach the LGBT curriculum that's laid down by national government. I'm just interested in your kind of inclusion devolution. What's your instinct about that? It's a bit of an unfair question, I know, but this is the kind of thing throws up.
Coming down to the brass tacks, what happens if somebody, and I'm not saying this is what is being, somebody actively preaches hate or disregard for other communities? I think that's where the laws of the land apply. That's where the values of the larger country apply. That's where inclusion trumps localism. Right. However, if they, you know, want to sell a particular kind of meat, they want to wear a particular kind of dress which doesn't, you know, harm anybody else, my sense is they should have the freedom to do that. So in that sense, there's ample room for exhibiting one's culture, for reveling in one's culture, but you're also part of a larger country. So you accept the values of that country. There's a civic nationalism that pervades the country. Now, some people sort of ask me, so what does this mean? You know, the community has the ability to form a number of laws. What if this goes, you know, can the community erect tariffs? Now, every country deals with this. In the US, you have something called the Commerce Clause, which essentially allows every state to decide what the production rules in that state are, what the minimum wages might be, what the some of the regulations will be, so long as they don't contradict national regulation. But importantly, the Commerce Clause says you can't erect tariff barriers against goods coming in from other states. We are one nation. Therefore, Congress will make rules about some of these things that will impinge on your freedoms to some extent, but that's what living in one country means. However, within that broader norm that Congress makes rules about commerce between states, states themselves have ample freedom to do what they want. So what I'm arguing for is this elevation of powers right up to the international level, push back right down to the community what you can. Follow the principle of subsidiarity, which the Union, European Union talks about, in spirit. Push it back as far as you can to give people more of a sense of agency. Be prepared for them to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. When I say push back curriculum to the local community, immediately in the US, I get the reaction, so should people be allowed to teach creationism? Well, if so long as it's harming themselves only, why not? Let them teach creationism. They will find that teaching creationism creates complications when your kid wants to, study the theory of evolution or do biology in some sense. So, you know, I think we shouldn't impose too much. We should allow for multiple experiments and people are not stupid. They will figure out what makes sense.
So the final question before I open it up, not as unfair as the question you were asked on the Today program yesterday. So I'm not going to ask about your aspirations to be governor of the Bank of England. But I can't resist asking this. As somebody who lives in America, who's a global, sees things from a global perspective, just tell me, if you can bear it, what do people think about what's going on in our country at the moment? What's people's perception of Britain? Is it, do people think we've gone completely mad, or do they just, or, I mean, what, I'm just kind of interested, really. I know it's a hard,
you know. It would be easy for people to laugh if similar sort of pressures weren't emerging in their own country.
Right.
I look at India and I see, you know, lots of similar questions and pressures. In the United States, there's gridlock between the Democrats and the Republicans. So I think, and that's why I say this is not individuals, this is not about President Trump, this is not about Brexit. It's a broader force. It's how we cope with technological change, which is hitting country after country, including the emerging markets. So we need to think about how to address this broader. There are no villains in my book, because the system is the villain. How do we address a situation where the system itself is a villain without throwing out everything in the system?
Thank you. Let's take some questions from around the room. There's two here. If you could say your name before you ask the question, and that'd be great.
Keith Best. I've chaired an international NGO based in New York and The Hague called the World Federalist Movement. And I want to come back to that last point you made. I mean, you very amply demonstrated how markets have become international, indeed transnational, sometimes with a great deal of resentment from the public who feel that there is no tap or no control over that. And we're having this argument about whether international organizations should be taxed in which particular country they operate and things of that nature. We have not seen any replication of that, or indeed a common desire for a replication of that at the governance level. And do not feel there's a massive mismatch now where your markets are moving inexorably and have moved into the international sphere, but our legislatures, our judiciary, our executives have remained firmly embedded in the nationalist country sphere, have not moved up into that commensurate international phase. Do you think that's a big imbalance that's going to cause massive problems, or is it something that can be accommodated?
Well, hold on yeah. To that. We'll take this together.
Yep. Is it working? Yeah. Thank you. One of your slides mentioned, my name's Aaron Arrell. You mentioned on one of your slides towards the end the secession of the successful. And I just wondered if what you thought about whether the metric of success was perhaps too linked to sort of power and money and feeling special. And as a sort of, maybe not the converse of that, but something that came to mind in my mind was in Scandinavian countries, they have a which regularly top the happiness indexes, they have a law of Jante, which basically tries to conform everyone to a sort of middling. And it's quite an interesting take on, you had a really good diagram which showed sort of norms that communities can impose. And I just wonder whether you had any thoughts about whether our definition of success in the countries you've talked about is too intrinsically linked to the acquisition of money and power and special status.
Thank you. And then finally, in this round, yep.
Yes, hello, Paquita de Zuleta, RSA Fellow. I just want to go back to climate change, which you said was one of the global problems. And I'm questioning, because you were saying capitalism enhances productivity, and efficiency, and of course technology does that perhaps even more so. Now, don't you think that there is actually a deep flaw here? Because how sustainable is it? Because what it's doing is making us produce more stuff, which we don't necessarily need, and the world, the Earth has got finite resources. So, you know, even the GDP itself is perhaps, we should be changing. It's about, you know, how sustainable is this growth? And there are alternatives. I mean, there is prosperity without growth. There is, for example, I think in Finland, they're doing what they call the circular economy, where everything is recycled, there's no waste, there's no pollution. You see, there is a problem here, which I don't know if you address in your book. I haven't read it yet.
Great questions.
Well, all great questions. On the markets internationalizing, and I actually sort of, that's important because I think governments also have this pressure to internationalize. And I agree with you, there are places where that might be necessary in order to sort of control markets. We talked about one, which was how do we fix taxation because of these tax havens where corporations, suddenly all the intellectual properties in Luxembourg or Ireland, which essentially moves profits there. And I think there is a place where some cooperation between governments is important. At the same time, we have to be careful about internationalizing government too much because of the sense of disempowerment of people when everything is done there rather than here. So I would stress push back whatever you can back closer to people so that they have a sense of control, they have a sense of what the officials are doing and can change and comment on that. But certainly there is scope for some international dialogue on some of these things, international crisis management, that those are areas where dialogue is possible. On the secession of the successful and am I overemphasizing monetary returns, I agree with you entirely that society sets the norms and values for people. And increasingly, over the last so many years, it has been monetary success than elsewhere. But that can change. And what you see today is views like the last question, which is, should we not be more about more than production because production also causes some harm, or more than consumption because consumption comes at the expense of the environment? But you know, these billionaires who've taken the giving pledge to give away at least half their wealth, but also I think increasingly society is saying, you know, just because you're a great entrepreneur doesn't mean you're a great person. What else are you doing? And I think it's quite possible over time the community worker, the nurse, the helper may get much greater social recognition than the guy who makes the most money. I think what I want to emphasize in the book is social norms change, and they change with what we want in some sense. Sometimes it's towards glorifying capitalism. I think Hindi movies, the capitalist used to be a rogue with a cigar, which is bad in India, smoking, a drink in the other hand, and usually, and this was in the age of massive sexism, a mall lightly clothed, draped around him. That was what was the rogue then. Today, it's the successful capitalist who's the hero of movies with a love interest who is equally accomplished, and they're jet-setting across the world. So that's where you've gotten more capitalist in values. In the US, on the other hand, you have a situation where Lego makes a movie. I mean, Lego is a business. It's making a movie to entice kids to use Lego toys. But the villain of the movie is Lord Business, is a toy which is Lord Business. So the nature of Hollywood movies is now to frame the corporation as the villain. And you can see sort of the society, which is supposed to be more capitalist, is actually moving back from aggrandizing capitalism. The society, which was more socialist, India was a socialist country, 60s, 70s, 80s, is moving towards making capitalism okay. I think social values change, and certainly we will attribute more value to other actions over time, and for the reasons that I think you say. And finally, on climate change, is it sustainable? Look, I think we are seeing a change in the next generation, but it needs work. It needs work, and I think we should embrace some of the values. For example, in India, everything is recycled because everything has value. And you have people who make money out of, you know, grabbing rags together and using and selling those to the recycler. So in that sense, I do think we should learn more broadly about how societies use resources. And I don't think the ultimate aim is for everybody to consume as wastefully as we are consuming in industrial countries today. That change is taking place, and what I would argue, however, is capitalism can make that change if you apply the right sort of incentives and costs, even as values also change to increase the pace of that change. So taxes, for example, carbon taxes, would help significantly in changing our attitude towards emissions.
And we've seen all the growing interest in Green New Deal. We've got time for one last round, if you're brief in your questions, and Rango is brief in his response. There's one there, and there's one there, and there's one there. That's it, yeah.
Thank you very much for the fascinating presentation. My name is Jim Williams. I'm the founder of Hatch back here. Hello, hi. We're the campaign to help citizens fix the world around them. In that spirit, it would be terrific to hear in the last few minutes your key points for how to revive community in a polarized world. We've heard some points around decentralization. I'm sure you have much more that you can add before we have to leave.
You may have to buy the book.
John Featherby. Next week I am giving the keynote at the launch of what is called the Jersey Good Business Network. So it's the great and the good of Jersey coming together around a charter about what better business means. So how do we? What message would you have for them about marrying the dichotomy between being a valuable community but also being very actively involved in the whole tax saving question? And then linked to that, do you have examples specifically of businesses that have taken a very active role in locally awakening community locally?
Chitra Sundaram, RSA Fellow. Wanted to thank you for your talk. And the question is, have you had a chance to talk about these issues, particularly of strengthening the communities, with any world leaders on a one-on-one basis or in small groups? And what has typically been their response?
Great. You've got 2 minutes to answer those three questions.
Okay, very quickly. I think on the decentralization aspect, actually, it's a package. You want to certainly empower the community more while making it sort of subject to the laws of the land and to open markets. People are very important. Good leaders in the community often drive the community response. So how do we keep good people, make them stay in the community? And there's some very interesting experiments across the world. Because people have a natural affinity to stay, but if the opportunities are not there, they want to leave. So how do you push opportunities back to the community, but also give incentives for good people to stay? There's some discussion of that in the book. Community engagement is very important. How do you get the community sort of engaged in the revival? Because it can't just be the leader leading and nobody following. And I think technology allows for much greater community engagement than was possible in the past. But you also need outside support. Not so much in here's what you do, but if you do, you know, whatever you want to do, we are there to help counsel, help provide sometimes financial support, sometimes infrastructure support. I mean, in the United States, it's a tragedy that many communities are without broadband. In this day and age, it means you're shut out of the digital economy. We need to figure out how to do those things. Better business. I would say that I'm not saying necessarily that business should take over the role of the government. Each one has its own sphere, and it would be a mistake for business to replicate what the government does. But where business can do some things which the government cannot do in a more effective way, that is something that it needs to consider whether it wants to do it. I would argue that, for example, investing in its employees, especially long-term employees, makes sense from both from the business perspective, but also from the longer-term societal perspective. Better business is about giving your employees a better chance over time, and it's good business makes good business sense also. There are a number of things like this that business can think about, which are not contrary to its basic function of producing good products, of giving consumers choice, but also in the process participating well in society, and we can talk more about that. That certainly is more in the book. And as far as world leaders go, no, I was keeping quiet till I wrote the book. I mean, I've learned a lot from one person I talk a lot to, which is Tharman Shanmugaratnam, who is the Deputy Prime Minister of Singapore. Singapore is trying a lot of things. It's a state which has extraordinarily good leaders. But certainly, once I've written this book, I hope to talk more with others.
Great. Well, the RSA is involved in loads of the areas we've talked about today. We're doing a project on the circular economy in communities. We're doing work on tech and society. We're doing work on good employment. So if you don't know as much about the RSA as you ought to know, then go and look at our website and find out more about our programme. If you're not a fellow, we'd be really interested in talking to you about fellowship. Thank you for coming today. Thank you for your brilliant questions. We have only floated on the surface of this great book. If you want to read the rest of the book, which I encourage you to do, it's available outside. I'm sure Roger will hang around and sign it. And who knows, if the Today programme speculation is right, you might be able to sell it on eBay. But that's it for us. It just remains me to ask you to thank our fantastic speaker, Raghu Rajan.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.